hören die Sendung Wellenlänge. Vous écoutez la transmission Longueur d'onde. Udite la trasmissione Lunghezza d'onde. You are hearing the transmission called Wavelength.
This is Captain Setby, is?
Just put a call through to him, sir.
Thank you.
No, just put a call through to him. You're going to hold.
I didn't understand what you said.
I said just put a call through to him. Can you hold a minute?
Oh, yes. Righto.
Who's speaking again?
Captain Maurice Seddon, S-E-D-D-O-N. He knows me.
Captain Seddon.
Seddon. S for sugar, E, double D for dog, O-N. Seddon.
Seddon.
That's it.
Okay, sir. Hold him, please.
Hello, it's Maurice Seddon. How are you?
Oh, I'm all right. Just off to Greece, actually.
Oh, you're going on holiday?
Yes, taking some furniture to our house there. Yep.
Oh, I see. Are you going today?
Tomorrow, actually.
I see. Well, forgive me troubling you in the Aufbruch, as it were, but the thing is, William English, who you know, has consulted me in despair. He has, in effect, invoked my assistance. Let me explain the situation. On the one hand, in financial terms, I'm the merest grain of sand on the beach. I'm as poor as a church mouse. Yet in other respects, I am extraordinarily well connected, and I have certain abilities in getting quite phenomenal results in terms of speeding things up in many fields. Now, to give you an example of something that happens relatively frequently and happened as recently as about 10 days ago, supposing a user of wireless communication has a breakdown of a telecom line to their control point, and they try through all normal means to get it right, and after 14 days or more, the thing still isn't working, and all normal means have broken down, they then refer the matter to me as a sort of, as something, an unicum, ganz auf Deutsch. And this unicum is then engaged to deal with the matter, with the result that within 22 hours the thing is working again.
Huh.
And this happens not once, but it happens often, and it happens in many fields. Now, I have never, ever had the problem before of dealing with a tardy and lackadaisical surveyor. I know absolutely nothing about surveyors. But I'm very much a ginger merchant and a go-getter, and in that I have been invoked to do this thing, I'm going to do my absolute damnedest, and I shall stop at no limit to get the thing put right. But before I do anything, I wanted to consult with you and make sure that the situation as I have been told it by William English really is the case.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. Today in the studio, I have two live guests, Mr. Richard Thomas. Good afternoon, Richard.
Afternoon, William.
And Jonathan Bowman.
Hello.
Of the notorious Bowman brothers. We've had
Hello,
your
indeed.
Your brother yes. Adam has been on the programme before.
Oh, right. Okay.
But you're also a solo performer?
Very occasionally.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Okay. You know. But, Richard, the studio will be familiar to you.
yeah. Yes, a bit too familiar. I just tweeted then, actually. I just said I thought I had escaped. Too completely familiar to me, yes, of course.
Yes, because you were studio manager.
I was the content manager and news editor.
Sorry, I was getting it wrong.
The commission... Yeah, yes. Yeah, I guess I was like the sort of commissioning editor, if you like, for Resonance for... I think about 9 years, but I'd probably worked here for about 10 years, and then I retired in April.
Right, and you now have a Maserati parked outside.
That's right.
So you're obviously successful at something.
Well, the payoff happened? Was good, and yes, the you know, no. No
what's going on in your life? What do you do now?
What's going on at the moment? I'm trying to do as little as possible, okay. William. Actually,
right. So early retirement then?
Yes, pretty much.
Right.
Well, no, you have to kind of reverse engineer the way you'd engineered your life, you know, in order. To work here, but no, I'm doing a few artistic projects. Working on some stuff that's going to come out next year.
Still radio sound stuff, or
sound stuff, and you know, quite a bit of video stuff, and also Jonathan and Adam and I have been working together for a long time, a decade or more, and we had a slight. Pause over the last couple of years, but we've sort of restarted working together, and we have a CD coming out next year, and we've been doing lots of small shows, gearing up to more stuff and some other projects, and that's, I guess, in some ways, that stuff is.
So we could probably place a couple of tracks off the CD towards the end of the program.
I think that would be.
But good. Ostensibly, you are here to discuss Valerian Borowczyk, the Polish film director, who I think died in 2006, something like that. International acclaim. Why?
Well, because it was a sort of serendipitous thing. We'd been thinking of Borowczyk, and he's always not far away from. My thoughts, because I really admire his filmmaking, and I think it was only maybe a few months ago that I suddenly thought of him and just decided to check out what was, you know, if there was any new developments in available films and things, because a lot of his stuff isn't available, and then I think it was Richard found a. Some sort of essay or something by a chap called Daniel Bird, who's a film historian, lives in Warsaw.
Oh, right.
And it quickly became evident that he knew chapter and verse on Borowczyk and was doing a lot of stuff right now. Just so it was interesting timing.
Yeah.
Just started to.
Is he based in Warsaw?
He's based in Warsaw. Yeah, right. And he's just starting various programs of restoration of prints. For the films and production of DVDs and talking to various agencies. And he's written a book and he's got a website devoted to Borowczyk.
Yeah.
So it's a tremendous amount of stuff. And I think
he started sort of making films in sort of the late 40s, I think. was it 1948? Was it always animated shorts to start with?
Yeah. I can't remember his first one, but it was around about that time.
Sort of what came to be known as pixelation rather than animation, wasn't it? Is it moving sort of objects and so on?
Yeah, it's stop frame stuff. Yeah. But I think, you know, there's quite a bit of drawn animation. I mean, you know, it's quite hard as well because, I mean, you know, obviously Mr. Bird is trying his best to make this stuff more widely available. But you can find quite a bit online, but it's, you know, it's quite hard to discern, you know, necessarily where things are coming from and how, you know, they're made. But yes, he also, though, I think it becomes evident in the interview, I believe, started making films as a child.
Oh, right.
You know, okay. Was he young? Well, a child.
Born in the 20s, wasn't it? About 1923 or 6 or something like that. Mm. So, I mean, the only film that I'm really familiar with, which I saw a long time ago, which really sort of, you never forget it, having seen the film once, I always remember it, was this sort of animated film of a wig. And it's like a wig sort of sitting on a sideboard or a desk. And it slowly starts to come to life, and they become, the hair of the wig sort of creeps out like tentacles. And it envelops a glass, like a liqueur glass, which is next to the wig, and starts to eat it. And so you hear the crunching sound of this wig sort of eating a glass. Well, I can't remember when that was made.
No, I wish I could say I remember. I know the one you mean, but I can't think of the title. But having said that, you know, Daniel Bird, along with Arrow Films, I think it is restoring a lot of those early animation films and a few feature films as well, and it's a project that's continuing.
So you've interviewed, the two of you have interviewed Daniel Bird, is that right? So today we're going to hear what a sort of taped conversation between the two of you and Daniel Bird. Where was this? Not in Warsaw, presumably.
No, it was at the Polish Cultural Institute.
Oh, okay.
On Poland Street in Soho.
Oh, right.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we recorded it a few weeks ago.
Right.
A few weeks ago, Daniel was over to, I don't know, discuss screenings and things like that.
Right. And this is on the occasion of something? They're releasing a particular DVD or film, or is it just off the cuff kind of... does it coincide with anything particular?
In the part we're playing, Daniel sort of describes all the plans that are afoot and exactly the schedule. Yes, but he was in talks with people, and that's why he was over in London. But everything's going to be happening in 2014 and... Yeah,
right.
Big things.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're a Borowczyk fan, you'd be very pleased, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's currently a kind of Kickstarter campaign to raise money for the kind of the, you know, final kind of stages of post-production. And I think the aim was to reach £20,000. And I think it's just under £300 short of that target. So any Borowczyk fans out there or aficionados, perhaps they should throw a few quid if they have it to spare. I'll get out the URL. I'll pluck out the URL for that Kickstarter fund.
Okay.
Perhaps, and you know, give it to the listeners after.
All right.
The pre-recorded interview sequence.
So, shall we proceed with the interview? So, this was Jonathan Bowman and Richard Thomas in conversation with Daniel Bird recently. How long ago? When was this?
About a month ago.
About a month ago on Poland Street at the Polish Institute, talking about Valerian Borowczyk, the noted. Can we call him avant-garde film director, or is he sort of, he was sort of art house, really, wasn't he?
I think that's what he was, just an artist, just a pure artist, fantastic artist in all mediums, but film, obviously, well known.
My memory of it is the sound of it. Dangerous, angry kind of animation. Can't even describe it. It's brilliant. All of his things were disturbing because they're all sexual. they sort of get in there into a world that I find activates a part of my brain that very few other things do. I haven't seen any of these films probably in 30 or 40 years, but they all have stuck with me. He's needs to be restored, and the world needs to be reminded.
Je vous réponds ça. C'est vrai, parce que d'ailleurs, chaque artiste est artisan, chaque artiste est alchimiste. Mais alchimiste dans ce sens qu'on fait la mixture, on mélange de différentes choses, on mixe, n'est-ce pas, et sort quelque chose d'inattendu.
Brafchik was a painter, he was a sculptor, and he was a filmmaker. He was born in Poland in 1923, and he emigrated to France in 1959, where he lived and worked for the rest of his life. He died in 2006. I think he's not just interesting, I think he's a really significant character, not just in cinema, but I would go as far as to say 20th century art. He was one of the first fine artists to work in film. I mean, now we're living in a time when people like Steve McQueen is on the Oscar race, and every review is prefaced by the idea, oh, you can see McQueen's background in fine arts and things like this. And we have people like Greenaway, we have people like David Lynch. But Brafchik was one of the first, and I think he gave many people, particularly in England, the confidence that you could emerge from a fine arts background and excel in photography and in film. I'm thinking of people like Craigie Horsfield, Andrzej Klimowski, the Quay brothers. And that's, I think, Brafchik's kind of historic significance. But for me personally, I'd go as far as to say that he is quintessentially cinematic. And by that I mean that film is a kind of language. It's a primarily essential language. It's a language of not just images, but moving images and also sound. It's about movement. And I think that's what really Brafchik was about. That was his kind of fascination. And he never saw a distinction. He's often talked about as an animator turned filmmaker, but he never ever saw a distinction between animated film and live action film. And one of the interesting things in terms of the reception of Brafchik is that you often find a review of a live-action short film mistakenly identified as an animation. And I think that has something to do with the intensity of his visual language in terms of composition, in terms of movement, in terms of the use of sound. And we talk about this renaissance of television today, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, etc., etc., etc. But as much as I like these programs, and I really do, they are the motor, the narrative motor as such, is verbal. They are teleplays in which the image is important, but it's not the fundamental thing. In the same way that, like we were talking earlier about essay films, the idea that if you actually write a commentary and then go out looking for images to illustrate or to counterpoint that commentary, that's very different from expressing yourself primarily in a visual form and then looking at kind of language as an accent, as a flavour, as a counterpoint, or as something to facilitate a broader visual narrative. And I think if you look at Borowczyk's films, whether it's the animated films, whether it's the live-action experimental films, whether it's the documentaries, or whether it's what are generally perceived as soft porn films, they had that real intensity of cinematographic language, you know, in the way that, you know, we read Joyce and we get pleasure out of this real play and love of language. I think that you can look at Borowczyk's films and get a similar love of somebody who was really kind of engulfed and possessed by cinematic form. Discovered Borowczyk in 1994 as part of a program of surrealistic animation. It also included, it was primarily films by Jan Schwankmajer. It was a program to support the release of Faust, his second feature film. And this program also included work by Jan Lenica, another poster artist who made animated films initially in conjunction with Borowczyk, but he later worked separately. And there were two or three films on 60mm which I saw, which completely floored me. Historically, those films were distributed amongst film societies in England when it was still a force to be reckoned with in the 1960s. But by 1994, as a kind of, they become victims of their own success. These prints were pink, scratched, they were falling apart. At the same time, I kind of came across a bootleg of one of Borowczyk's later films, Immoral Tales, which is kind of what you would call an erotic portmanteau film. Interestingly, Borowczyk never considered his films as erotic films. He said that they were, he found Disney films more pornographic. And what he meant by that, I think, is that there's a difference between being sexually explicit and being erotic. His intention was never to arouse people, but he was interested in sexuality as a theme. I mean, you would never call Salo erotic, but it nevertheless features sexual situations and naked bodies. And I think in a similar way, that's what kind of Borowczyk was doing. But to kind of bring those two things together, it fascinated me how somebody could actually produce work which was so radically different, experimental animation on the one hand, and this kind of expansive, taboo-busting, sexual-themed portmanteau film. And at the same time, there were all these weird connections. And I tried to put together a number of programs, ultimately a retrospective at the Lux Centre, which was in Hoxton Square, and this was back in 2001, with Ian White, who, you know, of course, recently died. But Ian was the guy out of all of the cinemas in London who basically said, let's do this. It was one of the last programs at the Lux, and it was really like a last hurrah, this kind of retrospective. And it really kind of upfronted the fact that Borowczyk really was such a strange, forgotten and bizarre artist. The fact that it was one of the first opportunities to really present a program of all facets of his career. But it also highlighted a problem, that many of these films were in bad prints. Many of them really suffered from the way they were distributed. They were dubbed, they were marketed as sex films in the UK. And Borowczyk, initially, he agreed to come across to London, but then he said, look, I can't come and stand before an audience and say, this is my film. They have to be perfect prints. And unfortunately, well, he died in 2006. Slowly, there were moments when, you know, I was lucky enough to be involved in the kind of making of a new print of one of his animated films, my favourite, Le Jeu des Anges, the Game of Angels, and that was 2006 or 7. It was part of the Independent Cinema Office Dreams programme. But the bulk of his work, as far as I'm concerned, which is the short films and animated films he made in France in the 1960s, his first feature-length film, The Theatre of Mr. and Mrs. Cabal, which is mostly animation with some live-action inserts, and also his second live-action feature, Blanche, were never distributed. Well, most of the films were not distributed ever in home video format, either on VHS. Blanche had a limited VHS run in the 90s and played on BBC TV once, even. But they were never on DVD. So, in fact, basically, people's perception of Borowczyk was based on the later films. And the irony is that sex sells. And the truncheon which critics were beating Borowczyk as this sellout, unfortunately, in this society where you know, things are driven primarily by commercial forces, it was these titles which were picked up by distributors because they could sell them. So it was this very lopsided picture of Borowczyk. It's this very, very weird sellout. And it has been a real kind of desire of mine, you know, for literally 15 years to find a way of getting the short films back in distribution and also the early features. And, you know, to make ends meet, I make DVD extras. I could call them documentary films, but no, that's what they are. They're DVD extras and they're little films designed to kind of embellish what you have. And one of the companies I started working for was Arrow Films, and I kind of proposed that, said, listen, you know, I know who the rights holder, which was Borowczyk's widow, and I know that I honestly think this could be something worth doing. It's a risk because there's no kind of reputation as such, but it's worth doing because these are really incredible films. And in short, Arrow took the risk, and they really, I think it was in it, an impulsive decision, an intuitive one, and we managed to restore the films. We kind of came to an agreement with Borowczyk's widow, which involved the restoration of 9 short films and 2 of the feature films, Mr. and Mrs. Cabal and Blanche, and we premiered these in the New Horizons Festival in Wrocław in July, along with new restorations of Moral Tales and The Beast, and also presented some archival films which I don't believe have been screened in a very long time. An experimental documentary Borowczyk made for German TV called Brief on Paris, which is a kind of 45-minute wordless postcard of Paris, which is shot with a 16mm camera, just impressions, which is quite remarkable, and it says something about the programming strategies of TV in the 1970s and how it is today. Mm. And also archival films, one particular one called Street Art, which was an educational film in Poland, co-written by an art historian called Szymon Bojko. And it's a 12-minute film about the function of the poster, the Polish poster, and there's not just the Polish poster, the poster in the street. And it's fascinating in terms of the commentary, because basically it says the poster is not that different from film in the way that you're using a combination of images and words to convey a theme or an atmosphere. So in a way, it's a little mini manifesto of Borowczyk's cinema before he's even really started effectively. So it was really interesting to kind of upfront those kind of neglected facets of his career, these documentaries, these rarer films, these animations he made for newsreels in Poland, as well as these new prints, and put those at the focus rather than the later films. I'm not saying that the later films are not worthy of attention, on the contrary, but what I am saying is that we should really not forget that the bedrock, the foundation of Borowczyk's career, is really this period from 1962 right the way through to 1971. This is really when he kind of established himself, not just as a filmmaker, but also as one of the titans of world cinema.
Thank you. Avec leurs pointes nues.
If you look at a film like Labatt in a good print in the cinema with good sound, that film is technically first rate. It was Borowczyk was incredibly up to date with technical innovation. There was the first Panaflex film in France was Labatt. This is an aspect of his films which shouldn't be ignored. They are technically first rate. There's nothing sloppy. The image is each film, and I think that's what attracts me to Borowczyk, and I think that's what makes him interesting and also difficult to write about, because when we talk about a filmmaker having a style and then we start to look from certain formal traits which kind of inform their identity as an auteur, when you look at Borowczyk's films, actually they're very different. Some are very kind of formal, and like the early films like Goto, they're shot predominantly with long lenses, very held back. And then other films like Behind Convent Walls, they're very intimate, handheld, and quite organic. And you can talk about the evolution of Borowczyk's aesthetic, and you can invoke reasons for that. You could say he was getting sloppy. I don't think that's the case. I think a lot of the fact is that he moved from shooting in the studio to shooting on location. Shooting quickly, he had less money. He preferred to work in freedom and sacrifice the budget. So he was working on location, very tight schedules, very quickly, using limited light sources. And I think above all else, what's interesting is that he always saw style as a function of the story. So basically, what style do I need to express this story? So Goto required a very formal style. Dr. Jekyll required a very different style. Both Goto and Blanche end the crescendo moment of both handheld sequences, and they're made even more startling, as you say, because the fact that the rest of the film is so formally kind of organised and controlled, you know, it's like a kind of a well-oiled machine which the gearing suddenly goes. It wouldn't be the same if it was kind of handheld all the way through, because the film is about a guy, without giving too much of the plot away, it's about a guy who meticulously plans an elaborate grand scheme to get something. And then the one thing he didn't plan happens. And then suddenly there's this kind of cold, chess-like, you know, way of conceiving the world goes to pot. And I think visually that's expressed in terms of this handheld camera, using a wide lens than the rest of the film, and using much a different style of lighting too. It's a lot harsher, the lighting in that handheld sequence as well. And in Blanche, you know, that sequence at the end of the film, when, you know, the film's based on the Mazzappa legend, and the idea when Mazzappa gets tied to the horse and the horse is sent away, that the way that film is shot, it's so radical, the idea that it breaks every rule in filmmaking language, the idea that, you know, traditionally if you're shooting a scene handheld, you always use a wide-angle lens because it minimises the shake. No, in this one you use telephoto lenses, and then you kind of like doing everything they tell you not to do on these little instruction videos on YouTube, but it works. It works perfectly, and I think that this is it's always funny when you go on YouTube and you see these filmmakers arguing about crossing the axis and this one and the other, the idea that there are some sort of concrete fundamental rules of cinema. Of course this is the case in classical Hollywood cinema, but it's certainly not the case in experimental film or not even experimental film, in kind of intuitive filmmaking. Borowczyk always considered himself like an alchemist. The idea that if you're a chemist, there is a method, a procedure, whereas alchemy, it's a lot more mercurial, there's a lot more intuition, and there's also a lot of excitement and risk. He always used to say, will the golem come to life or not? And I think in many of his films, you know, the golem certainly does come to life, the film does go bang. The end of Blanche, the end of Goto, the end of Dr. Jekyll, I mean, that ending of that film, I've screened it several times. It literally is jaw-dropping, without using kind of hyperbole. I mean, the amount of times which people, which you have this silence and you're thinking, the tonal shift, the way you've got a very, very pitch black comedy with some very dark humour, and then it kind of devolves into this intense abstraction which implies some very bizarre ideas and thoughts and feelings. It really is staggering, and that's the next challenge, how to rescue this film from legal entanglement. Borowczyk, the first professional films. It's important to remember that he was an amateur filmmaker from a very early age. As a kid, we were working on 8 and 16 millimeter film. But his first professional kind of films in the late 1950s with Jan Lanica in Poland, it was in 1957, a film called Once Upon a Time. And for the soundtrack, the same year, Polish radio established the Experimental Studio. So the first musical experiment to come out of the experimental studio by Andrzej Markowski were utilised in the soundtrack of Once Upon a Time. So, and I honestly think that when those films of Borowczyk and Lenica, with these soundtracks by Markowski and Wojciech Potoński, when they were actually screened at festivals, it really started to make a lot of animators think about the using electroacoustic music as a kind of if just as the animated image is non-photographically real, we should start using similarly non-realistic soundtracks and more music concrete. Like in Renaissance, I mean, there's some great gags, and there's a great moment. I mean, Renaissance is this conceptually brilliant film. It's a film which begins with a bombed out room, and then the film, in a very particular way, starts to reconstruct itself. It isn't just reverse, as it's often implied in kind of synopses. It actually slowly and meticulously and ritualistically kind of organizes, synthesizes, rebuilds itself. And there's a key part of the film is like a still life composition with a plate with some grapes on, and one by one the grapes appear, and he uses the typewriter sound, and it's it's funny more than anything else, but it's also a very interesting idea of the associating the shape of the typewriter button with the the kind of this, you know, this very called the and this kind of synesthesia which Eisenstein, which Borowczyk was a great admirer of, was similarly kind of exploring those kind of visual and sonic associations and tensions. And I think that, yeah, in a very, whereas Eisenstein was a very intellectual person who often, particularly towards the end of his career, forced ideas through, Borowczyk intuitively had a great feeling for this juxtaposition of sound and image. And, you know, and that association with those Polish composers continued in France, particularly with Parmigiani. I think he had a very, very fruitful relationship with Parmigiani. A lot of the films he made use early compositions of Parmigiani, which later appear in albums, Di Natura Sonorum and things like this. And I think, yeah, for me, it was Borowczyk was a window into that kind of music concrete surrounding Pierre Schaffer's studio. It really, it's two of my favourite things, Parmigiani and Borowczyk. Their final collaboration was a film called Dom, which won the gold medal at the Brussels Experimental Film Festival in 1958. This was part of the Brussels Expo, and there was a large cash prize, and this was split with the Polish state and then further split between Borowczyk and Lenica, and both decided to emigrate. They landed in France, and Anatole Damon, Polish-French producer, who was also the producer of Chris Marker, Alain René, early films by Agnès Varda, and later Godard, Bresson and Tarkovsky. He initially started producing short films and short animated films, so Borowczyk made a film for him. They needed a French name on the credit for purely administrative reasons. Chris Marker volunteered and said, look, I'll do this. And when I had some email correspondence with Marker, and he said his only contribution to the film, originally the film's about an astronaut and the co-pilot is a canary in Borowczyk's idea, but Marker suggested, no, we should change the canary to an owl. And Marker said that was his only real contribution. But he had a great admiration for Borowczyk, and he recommended Borowczyk to his assistant, a guy called André Heinrich. And Heinrich was in the process of setting up an animation studio called Le Cinéaste Associé with an entrepreneur called Jacques Forgeau. The idea was that Forgeau wanted to build a team of world-class animators, Alexeyev, Etienne Rake, the Bettiol brothers from Italy, and they would produce animations as short films which could be sold to distributors to be programmed before features, and also produce animated commercials, because he recognized, of course, that there was a boom in commercials and there was also a market still for the short film. And that Borovchik was employed primarily by Le Cinéaste Associé right until 1965, when he decided to form his own production company. And he was no longer obliged to make exclusively animation, and that's when he started to make more and more live action experiments. And I think people keep saying, why did he stop doing animation? From my point of view, it's very simple. The market for the short film was starting to die. Distributors realised that instead of buying a short film, you could sell that 10 minutes before the feature to advertisers. So the market of the short film started to die, and then it became almost exclusively the realm of the experimental or amateur filmmaker or the student filmmaker looking for a calling card. And I think that's rather unfortunate, because Borovchik really excelled in the short film format, and that's why in many of his feature films he made portmanteau films. And so that's really kind of the institutional context in which kind of Borovchik worked. And I think in the case of Parmigiani, I mean, Parmigiani was working with three Polish emigre filmmakers. He also worked on Lenitz's French short films, which were also produced by Damon, and also another Polish filmmaker called Piotr Kamler. Piotr Kamler, in addition to working with Parmigiani, also worked with François Bayle. So I don't know what it is about Polish emigres, but they certainly had an affinity for French electroacoustic music that was the product of Pierre Schaffer's kind of school, let's say.
You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and that was an interview with Daniel Bird by Jonathan Bowman and Richard Thomas, held at the Polish Institute on Poland Street about 4 weeks ago. Jonathan and Richard are both here in the studio with me. At the beginning of that recorded and edited interview, that was the voice of Terry Gilliam.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think also if you look at, well, I suppose, Gilliam, like a lot of people who are in art school, maybe inspired by Borovchik to experiment with film. And I think some of Borovchik's, some of Gilliam's animations, rather, you can see there's a quite discernible Borovchik influence, you know, in terms of, you know, there's a, the collage-based, for instance, and this is, I don't know, similar spirit. So yeah, that was Terry Gilliam plugging it, because of course, as I mentioned before, there's a, to restore the films, there's a Kickstarter campaign which is kind of achieved its target today, and the target was to achieve to reach £20,000 budget, and looking at it right now, they've gone £21 over target. If you know, you want to assist with you know, the finishing touches, if you like, you can probably the easiest thing to do is go to Kickstarter.com and search for Restore Goto, and Goto is spelled G-O-T-O. I suppose there's a few other websites, you know, I should give out whilst we're on the subject. You can find out quite a bit about Borovchik by going to Daniel Bird's website, obscurepleasures.com. And then Daniel also has a really interesting website looking at cinema, and it's called cavecanefilms.co.uk. So that's CAVECANE films.co.uk.
And if you people, anyone that contributes to this Kickstarter, what's the money going towards? What happens to the money? What's he doing with it?
I don't know. I guess it's
well, it's Goto actually. It's that specific project is the restoration of the print of Goto Île d'Amour, which was the second feature he made, and that has that's a fantastic film.
Right.
It's set in a a mythical island, on a mythical island, and it it features Ligia, Branice Borovchik, who was his wife, and also the woman who appears on the last frame of La Jetée. That was Ligia Branice.
So is she the woman in La Jetée?
Absolutely.
Throughout the,
is it? Sorry,
the film.
Yes, I can't recall it very well.
Yes, not, cause, yeah.
No, it's throughout.
Right.
That's her.
And, because, and they also collaborated on it. There was a Chris Marker and Borovchik film. Would you say Les Astronautes, which they did some collaboration on? Mm. Sort of.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Okay.
I think maybe Daniel actually mentioned that in the interview, but it's.
Right.
I think it's a technicality of production of film in France at that time that you had to have a French national as one of the production staff, if you like. So I think that was nominally Chris Marker.
Right.
But I think Daniel said that his contribution to the film was the astronaut, the protagonist, had an accomplice that Borovchik wanted to be played by a canary, and Marker... suggested that it shouldn't be a canary but an owl.
Right.
Which is quite Chris Markerish,
yes,
really, isn't
indeed.
It?
Indeed.
Chris Magic Marker, I believe, as he is credited on the film. Yeah.
Well, we're moving towards the end of the programme, and if we're going to play a track from the three of you, Jonathan and Adam Bowman and Richard Thomas, you are members of a band called Secluded Bronte. Can
That's
I call
correct.
It a band? Is that
yeah, it's a band, yes.
Sort of
ensemble. Trio.
You apparently toured the East Coast of America.
Yeah, a long time ago now, 11 years ago.
Yeah, and recorded this CD in the WFMU studios, it seems.
That's right. It was a radio session for Dave Mandrell's World of Echo, I think his show's called.
Uh-huh.
And it was just a, I think it was about 30 minutes or 35 minute long radio session, and we've edited it down subsequently to about 22 minutes.
Right.
Worked really well. It sounded really good, and it's always been, I've always thought, yes, we should probably do something with it, but it's taken this long to do something with it.
Right.
Now at last it will be coming out in spring on Al Margolis's label called Pogus. And it's called Secluded in Jersey City. That's the name of the album, and Jersey City is where WFMU is. So
right.
That's why it's called that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we could play a track from that to play out on.
Hmm.
What's the name of this track?
I think it's called Cyclops. I can't remember. I mean, it's been so long since we recorded this.
It is Cyclops, yeah. I think. But what you just told me, because Richard's done a little edit of it, the Cyclops is about 10 minutes long. This is an edit of Cyclops. If it's not, I'll let you know after I've heard it.
Anyway, it's on the LP. And also, actually, I suppose if you want to find out a bit more about Pogus, it's Pogus.com for a bit more information. I don't know if there's any information about this LP yet, as it won't be out until 2014 spring, but Should we have a listen to this?
Indeed.
This piece.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you to Richard Thomas and Jonathan Bowman for coming into the studio talking about Borovchik. And so this is from Secluded in Jersey City. Laptop. No? Local IP.
That's the one.
Got it.
You got
okay,
it?
Okay, yeah.
Off we go then.